This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Tuesday, the Prime Minister inches closer to net zero carbon emissions, but he says it won't be done in the cafes, dinner parties and wine bars of our inner cities. What does he mean? And a new way of exploring the planets as NASA launches a tiny helicopter on Mars.
This really is the beginning of a completely new way of exploring these alien worlds. The rovers are very slowly, cumbersomely moving across the surface. Well, now you've got your little buddy able to fly ahead and map it out.
But first today, we start the program with an in-depth look at the Royal Commission into Military Suicides. Yesterday, the Prime Minister announced the inquiry after increasing public pressure, including a petition with more than 400,000 signatures.
There have been many initiatives, but the problem is still with us. The grief of the families, the hardship of the comrades as they have fought together and then have to deal with the aftermath of the fight when they return here to this country and they find it so hard to adjust.
On average, a current or former member of the Australian Defence Force takes their own life each 2 weeks. A study commissioned by the Department of Veterans Affairs found there were 419 serving or veteran suicides between 2001 and 2017. In other words, more Australian military lives have been lost to suicide than on the battlefields of Afghanistan. Gavin Pearce is the federal member for the electorate of Braddon in Tasmania. He's lobbied hard for the Royal Commission. Before entering politics, he spent 2 decades in the Australian Army. Gavin Pearce has experienced the tragedy of losing young soldiers and veterans to suicide.
When one of your soldiers that you think so much of, that you spend so much time with, and that you'd give your life in an instant for, when they take their life by their own hand, that burden comes on to you. And it certainly come on to me over the years. I've lost count of the amount of young diggers that I've lost over my time. It never leaves you, that sense of responsibility. I've talked to, you know, the bodies of young soldiers and told them that how sorry I was that I didn't see it, that I didn't recognise the signs, that I didn't act, that I didn't know, that I should have known. I missed it. That feeling of responsibility and almost guilt, I think, is ever present in any leader that we have in our armed forces.
What do you think's gone wrong?
From my personal view, I think we've seen layer upon layer upon layer of impact that collectively has resulted into this number that we see that's, as far as I'm concerned, not acceptable and out of control. We take young civilians off the street, and I trained them for many years at our recruit training establishment, turned them into soldiers, intelligent, fit, young person, and we're training them to not only withstand the rigours of service life, but also to take another human life. That's our goal, that's our mission. Now, in order to do that, we have to condition that young person to enable that outcome. We don't use words like take another life or to kill somebody. We use words like eliminate, destroy, neutralise the target. We don't even call them a person. So we dehumanise that act. Consequently, you tend to have an effect that is a dehumanising of the value of life. That remains with that young person when they exit defence. You then take them into some of the most dangerous places on the planet, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the list goes on, and you subject them to the rigours of war. You post them all over the country, you know, with their families. Again, it has a toll on families, and we know that our divorce rates within defence are much higher than the civilian world. And then we put another layer, once they exit defence, in that all that training that we did to condition them to do their job, their mission, we now need to untrain them. We now need to train them for the new life, for the civilian world. And it's a completely different world. We add all those things together, and I think that is where the recipe for disaster starts.
Do you think 5 years from now that the situation will have improved when it comes to serving and veteran suicides?
It's got to. Sally. It really has to. And we have got to do something with these numbers. And, you know, I honestly cannot think of anything else that we've done with this Royal Commission, the powers of the Royal Commission, the ability to reach back, the ability to reach forward, the families advocate, you know, things like the Veterans Transition Authority. We've looked after employment. You know, that $11.5 billion that we've put into looking after our veterans. You know, hopefully this Royal Commission will help us spend that money to its best effect. And we need an outcome driven inquiry. And hopefully this will do it.
That's former soldier, now federal MP, Gavin Pearce. Well, Harry Moffat is a former SAS team commander and is now a practicing psychologist. He says the suicide risk factors for current and former soldiers are complicated. Harry Moffat believes more work needs to be done to determine why veterans are taking their own lives.
Certainly there's, upon separation from defence, when we see the highest prevalence of mental health issues, and it goes to the point there's a lot of nuance in this, Sally, that we need to kind of pick over and examine a lot more. For instance, you know, it appears that the less time you've spent in defence, the higher the likelihood of mental health issues. And we also know that mental health issues can happen in clusters, either units or subunits. So it's a bit more complicated than just all veterans are at higher risk of suicide.
Well, Harry, can we go back through a couple of those things? What do we know about that first issue about sometimes people spending less time in defence may be at higher risk?
Yeah, well, there's been some studies done by the government. You know, one of the most vulnerable groups are those who have discharged via injury in the first few years of their service. So they may not have even seen any operational deployments, and not that that's important, but I think it's key in understanding the data. We also had, there's a massive spike in women, mental health prevalence in women in defence in the last 10 years. And that to me speaks of we just haven't collected enough data yet.
And Harry, you were talking earlier about clusters in units as well. Tell us about that.
It's still unclear in the Australian context, but I'm aware of particular units appearing to suffer more mental health challenges in their soldiers than others. And in the US, we know of several case studies, I guess, of units having multiple suicides from, you know, small populations, platoons, or company level size units. So again, it points to the nuance in all of this, and I think you know, it can be a bit fraught just kind of using blanket terms like all veterans are vulnerable to mental health issues. There's a bit more detail required to kind of extract out of it.
Harry, this announcement about the Royal Commission is happening in the context that the government announced last week that it will be withdrawing Australia's remaining troops from Afghanistan. How does the end of this war affect the bigger picture? There's no chance for a last-minute miracle now. In a sense, we have lost that war in many senses. How does that play into the bigger picture of mental health and how veterans and the community may view that very, very long 20-year conflict?
Yeah, for each individual have their own journey. I'm sure any veteran who's served around Chora or Baluchi, just north of Tarin Kaut, where arguably more Australians lost their lives or were wounded or experienced, you know, extreme events in that part of Uruzgan, I'm sure many of the veterans from there will reflect, you know, mixed feelings about it being handed back over to the control of the Taliban or whoever, whatever other factions. But again, all I can say is on each individual as they're reflecting and taking that journey, just to be proud of the work that we've done. It's probably the case that these wars are no longer winnable. So I think there's some comfort in that, but each individual needs to reflect themselves, and if they are struggling, they need to reach out to someone and discuss it with them.
That's Harry Moffat, a former SAS team commander and now a practicing psychologist. He also helps to run the Wanderers Education Program for SAS veterans. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Well, the fraught issue of climate change policy in Australian politics is back in the headlines, and with it, some divisive language. The Federal Opposition is hosting a Clean Jobs Summit focused on Australia's move into greener industries, but it's the Prime Minister's comments on climate change ambitions and a swipe he's taken at inner-city types that have got some fired up. Caroline Winter joins me now from Parliament House. Caro, what are the comments that the PM has made and what's the response been?
Well, Sally, the Prime Minister has inched closer to committing Australia to a net zero emissions target by 2050 during a speech at a business dinner in Sydney. He conceded the nation's energy mix does need to change over the next 30 years, something that he says will be done through the commercialisation of low emissions technology rather than taxes. But net zero targets, it's a deeply divisive issue within the coalition. Some claim shifting away from traditional industries like coal to reach those targets will kill jobs and manufacturing in regional areas, but there's also a sentiment within inner city Liberal held seats that the government needs to do more on the issue. It's a balancing act, no doubt, for the Prime Minister. Here's a snippet of what Scott Morrison said last night as he walks that fine line in keeping both sides of the debate within his ranks on side.
We're not going to achieve net zero in the cafes, dinner parties and wine bars of our inner cities. It will not be achieved by taxing our industries that provide livelihoods for millions of Australians off the planet, as our political opponents sought to do when they got the chance. It will be achieved by the pioneering entrepreneurialism and innovation of Australia's industrial workhorses, farmers and scientists.
That's the Prime Minister speaking at a business dinner last night. National's frontbencher Darren Chester has backed Scott Morrison, saying inner-city Australians have dictated climate policy for too long.
I have to agree with the Prime Minister because we're a little bit sick and tired out here in regional Victoria of being told what jobs we can and can't have by people who live in the city. I mean, we've seen cuts to our traditional industries like commercial fishing, like the timber industry. We've seen cuts to things like the mountain cattlemen, all brought about by people in the cities telling country people what jobs they can have. We're a little bit sick of it. So the country people want to have their traditional industries. They want to do their share in terms of emissions reduction. They're very practical environmentalists in regional areas. They're the people who join land care. They join coast care. They do pest animal control. They do weed control. They are environmentally minded, but they're a little bit sick and tired of being told what they can and can't do by people who don't even live here.
National's frontbencher Darren Chester there, but Scott Morrison's approach isn't washing with all within his ranks. Outspoken supporter of the future of coal, National Senator and former Resources Minister Matt Canavan says there's no way Australia can reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050 without thousands of job losses. He's tweeted that Australia trying to go for net zero emissions is like a 10-year-old boy who thinks he's Superman and jumped off his parents' roof. He doesn't have the technology and he's going to fall flat on his fails. Now, all of this comes days before Scott Morrison participates in US President Joe Biden's virtual greenhouse gas summit.
And just finally and briefly, Labor's been holding a climate summit today, Clean Jobs Summit. What's come out of that?
Yeah, it's in a case of dual speeches on the nation's climate future. Labor's hosting that Clean Technology Jobs Summit with industry, climate groups and unions. They're considering issues like regional development, electrification, new export opportunities and heavy industry, among others. And opposition leader Anthony Albanese says greener industries are at the centre of the summit and he's promising a revolution in jobs growth right across the economy.
Caro, thank you. That's our reporter Caroline Winter at Parliament House in Canberra. Well, in a major revision of the country's troubled vaccine rollout, National Cabinet has agreed that the vaccination of all Australians over the age of 50 will be fast-tracked. State-run vaccination hubs are likely to be used to get shots into arms faster, but the full details are yet to be finalised. Alexia Atwood reports.
Melbourne GP Shea Wilcox should be run off his feet right now. In anticipation of Australia's GP-led vaccination rollout against COVID-19, he rented out an empty retail space next to his clinic in Brunswick East and turned it into a large hub. But he says he just doesn't have the shots to put in arms.
If there was a community outbreak, it would be an absolute disaster that we haven't increased the number of vaccinations.
State and territory leaders have reached an in-principle agreement to bring forward the vaccination of Australians over 50 years of age in a so-called reset of the program. Dr. Wilcox is pleased with this, but says it just raises more questions.
If the supply is there, then I think that's a great idea. However, we have the capacity to vaccinate a lot of people, but we don't have any vaccinations.
Some states and territories are already establishing mass vaccination hubs. Doctors such as Shea Wilcox remain sceptical about them, though.
It seems to me like the government is trying to pivot a little bit and throw out this mass vaccination hub word because people are getting frustrated.
When really the GPs, you believe, are ready and can do a bulk of that work, it's just you need the supply.
Absolutely. Like I've talked to, you know, friends and colleagues, and nobody can get any vaccines.
Mass vaccination hubs have worked in other countries, including the US. The United States' top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, has weighed into Australia's vaccine rollout debate.
I wouldn't be that hard on Australia if this is the beginning of your program, because you always expect some stumbles early on. We had to initiate things that, you know, really were rather creative, and we had to do them in response to the fact that we wanted to be very efficient. For example, we set up community vaccine centers so that it would make it easy for people.
Around 1.5 million doses have been administered in Australia, but in the US, half of all adults have received at least one dose, and everyone above the age of 16 is now eligible for a shot. Jane Holton chairs the Coalition of Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. She agrees it's wise to focus on vaccinating everyone over 50 now, while also meeting the needs of all priority groups.
This is absolutely the right thing to do. And to be honest with you, the sooner we actually make that decision, so we make it less complicated for people to understand that it is their opportunity now, go and find someone to get vaccinated, I think the better off we're going to be.
Australia has received around 4 million doses of the Pfizer and AstraZeneca vaccine so far, but only 1.6 million have been administered. Some need to be kept for second doses. But Jane Holton says Australians deserve full transparency about the availability of all those vaccines.
One of the things we should all be asking for, and I think people are trying to do this, but it's hard, is to be really transparent about what is where. And I think the data you just quoted, and that's an attempt at that, and congratulations to the people who've compiled that information. I think we're looking for more, though. Let's hope with the bolstering of logisticians in the Department of Health that that's one of the outcomes, and pretty soon, so we can all see and encourage people to take up this vaccine.
That's Jane Holton, the chair of the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. Alexia Atwood with that report. Well, the new Home Affairs Minister Karen Andrews is under pressure to release a Tamil family from immigration detention on Christmas Island. Labor Senator Christina Keneally has visited the parents and two children who've been in detention for 3 years after being removed from their home in the Queensland town of Biloela. Department officials say the family's claims for protection have been comprehensively assessed. But Senator Keneally argues the minister should exercise her discretion, as Stephanie Smale reports.
Tamil parents Priya and Nadez and their two girls are the only family in detention on Christmas Island.
They live in essentially two rooms. The family all sleep in one bedroom on a queen bed and a single bed, and the other room has another single bed with all their clothes and belongings stacked on it.
Labor Senator and Home Affairs spokeswoman Christina Keneally has travelled to the island to meet with the family in person.
Priya is clearly lonely and depressed in detention. Even as we sat in the sterile visitors' room in the detention centre, it's clear she's an extrovert. She loves being around people, and during our visit she spoke often of her desire to go home to my community in Bilo. Nadez, the father, he's the quieter of the two, but I sense a deep and profound sadness when he speaks. He's stuck in a situation he cannot resolve. He can't work, he can't look after his family, and he can't get a way out.
The family has been held on Christmas Island since 2019, when an injunction stopped them from being deported to Sri Lanka. The Home Affairs Department has told The World Today both girls go to school and socialise with other children on Christmas Island, and the family are offered excursions, including picnics and sightseeing. A spokesperson says the family has multiple rooms in their accommodation and have access to the internet and phone services to contact friends, family and their lawyers. But Senator Keneally points out they are the only children living in detention in Australia.
These two parents both look at their most overwhelmed when they're talking about the effects of detention on their children. These girls are just too young to understand why they can't live in a house, why they can't go to the shops, why they can't go to their friends' houses or have friends over.
Former Industry Minister Karen Andrews has taken over the Home Affairs portfolio, and the ABC understands she has requested a high-level briefing on the Tamil family's situation. Christina Keneally says as a first step, they should be released into the local community to live in one of the houses she says are owned by the Commonwealth, while their legal battles to stay in Australia play out.
Given the small community here, some 1,500 residents, the strong support they have from the residents, you know, I would urge the minister to consider, as a first step, allowing Nadez, Kopaka and their two little girls to move into the community, to come out of living in detention.
Labor says the federal government has spent $50 million of taxpayers' money keeping the family in detention. The Home Affairs Department spokesperson points out the family's claims to engage Australia's protection obligations have been comprehensively assessed by the department and the court system with no success.
That's Stephanie Smale reporting. Finally today, in just a few short years, drone aircraft have been steadily changing our world as they've been put to use for military, security and civilian purposes. But now they've begun conquering space too, with NASA's first test flight of a tiny helicopter, which has been launched from the surface of Mars. Humankind's first powered flight in an alien world now promises to be the start of a new era in interplanetary exploration. Nick Grimm reports.
This flight control, confirming that we have EVRs from Ingenuity.
It's the size of a tissue box and a long way from home, not to mention a sizeable to-do list to check off before it could touch base again with ground control at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California.
Spin up, take off, climb, hover, descent, landing, touchdown, and spin down.
But after a 39-second mission and a few hours to relay its messages to Earth, news finally reached a team of scientists anxious for confirmation that Ingenuity's mission to master the skies of Mars had been a success.
Altimeter data confirmed that Ingenuity has performed its first flight of a powered aircraft to another planet.
Yeah, this flight was all about proving that it is possible to fly on Mars.
Havard Grip is the tiny helicopter's chief pilot.
So to that end, what we had instructed Ingenuity to do was to climb to altitude of 3 metres, hover there for a little bit, about 5 seconds, then make a turn of about 96 degrees, hover for another 20 seconds, and then go to land again in the same place that it took off from. And that's what we told Ingenuity to do, and it did exactly that, and it did it just perfectly.
At a time when unmanned drone aircraft encircle the Earth and carry out complex missions for pilots sometimes located thousands of kilometres away, a short takeoff and landing by a small craft on the surface of Mars might not seem such a major breakthrough to the uninitiated, but NASA's Steve Jurczyk insists it is a big deal.
This really is a Wright brothers moment. It's the start of a whole new kind of planetary exploration.
And the Wright brothers' history-making first flight only lasted 12 seconds itself. So it's not so much the journey that matters as reaching the destination. Mimi Ong is the Ingenuity project manager.
It looks easy. I would like to take this opportunity to remind how difficult it is to fly a rotorcraft at Mars, first and foremost, because the atmosphere there is so thin.
Really, it's a triumph of engineering to make this craft function, and over the coming weeks, we'll now see ever more advanced tests to really push it through its paces.
Alan Duffy is an astronomer at Swinburne University and lead scientist of the Royal Institution of Australia. He believes Ingenuity's first flight has launched a new era of interplanetary exploration by offering a new perspective on space probes sent to visit the surfaces of Mars and beyond.
The rovers are very slowly, cumbersomely moving across the surface. We're always worried they might get in trouble and go down ditches or get stuck in an area that we just couldn't see. You only have that one camera from the rover. Well, now you've got your little buddy able to fly ahead and map it out.
That's astronomer Alan Duffy from Swinburne University, and that was Nick Grimm with that report. And that's all from The World Today for this Tuesday. The PM team will be along this evening. We'll be back again at the same time tomorrow with more stories from across Australia and around the globe. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara. Stay safe and have a great afternoon.
For now, Australia is the land which COVID forgot. But there's no chance it can stay that way. As of this week, we are in a travel bubble with New Zealand. And more countries will follow. But the price of admission in the long term is giving up our run of zeros.
Today on The Signal, what comes after New Zealand? And are we ready to deal with the consequences? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.